gives us tremendous delight, doesn't it, Simon? It's one of the few things that we actually agree on. To speak to this guy, his name is Avi Yorish. He's an author. He's an academic. He's one of the smartest, smartest people on the planet, as certainly as I believe. And I think last week I was going to give him the Nobel Prize.
Yeah,
yes, if there were two, he would get two.
Yeah, just a little bit of exaggeration. I mean, it's all right. He's got a brain in his head, but, you know, the Nobel Prize, you pushed it a bit far, Kathy.
No, I didn't. Did I, Avi?
No. I think I'm with Simon on this one. Simon, thanks. I appreciate the background.
Okay, so you know what? I'm going to get up. I'm going to leave. The two of you can just talk amongst yourselves.
No, so listen. So this week, I want to take the advantage. I want to take the... I want to take the opportunity and actually talk about you a little bit, because we haven't done that. And I want to understand where, what, and how. But I also want to talk about Al-Azhar, because I want to be wanted to do that for 3 weeks.
What's Al-Azhar?
So Al-Azhar is the oldest university in the world. It's over 1,000 years old. It's the preeminent school of Sunni Islamic learning. It basically is the grand yeshiva of the Sunni Muslim world. And it's one of these bastions of Islamic thought. And I had the great privilege to study there, almost 20 years ago. I studied Quran, Fiqh, and Hadith. It's, as I said, located in Cairo. Many, many members of Al-Qaeda graduated from that particular institution, including the leader of Al-Qaeda today, Ayman al-Zawahiri.
So two things I want to pick up on that. Firstly, I am absolutely fascinated by Jews, Judaism, and Islamic world. Done a course that spurred me on to read, so I went to get a book called In the House of Ishmael by Martin Gilbert. In that book, Martin Gilbert writes, and I don't know if this is true or not, one would like to think it is, that Yaqub ibn Kilis, who was a convert to Islam but a Jew, was one of the absolute founders of that institution, and I can't imagine that is correct. Do you know anything about that, Javi?
I can't say that I do, but I can say that there have been certainly many, many Jews who converted into Islam over the course of many years, including, I would say, at the very foundation, the very founding of Islam. Interestingly, in the Quran, we learn that the Jewish people worship Uzair, which is obviously not true, but they are listed as having worshipped Uzair. And the leading thought on that today is actually, so you had Jews that left the state of Islam, what is today the state of Israel, the area of Israel, and came into the Arabian Peninsula. There were Jewish tribes that they talk about in the Quran, and that many of which eventually converted into Islam. We actually believe today these were the first Jews for Jesus. These were the Jews that converted to Christianity. They still considered themselves Jews. They came into the Arabian Peninsula and became part of the Muslim nation.
Tell me about that university itself. Did you study in Cairo, or did you do it by correspondence?
No, I studied in Cairo. I lived in Cairo for almost a year and a half, and I studied at Al-Azhar, and I studied at the American University in Cairo. At the American University in Cairo, I really focused on Arabic language studies, and at Al-Azhar, I really studied Islamic philosophy, theosophy, and so on.
I mean, you've just said that this is a center of Sunni Islam, with graduates being the head of Al-Qaeda. How did that work for you? And were you...
I mean, look, this is not an institution, obviously, that really is only promoting radical thoughts. And this is where I really want to be very clear. You have 1.4 billion Muslims on the planet. Far from many of them are promoting radical thoughts. There are many at this institution that do, but certainly the vast majority of Muslims around the world, I would say, do not promote radical thinking. Al-Azhar is an interesting institution and is a bastion for both radical and non-radical thoughts, but it's an institution that we must take seriously and use it as a bellwether to see what is coming out of the institution today.
Your experience of being a Jew studying in Cairo, what was that like?
You know, it's an interesting question. I really felt often like a stranger in a strange land. It was, for me, one of the highlights of my professional career. When I was a small child, I grew up in Israel. And for your listeners who spent time in Israel in the 70s and for part of the 80s, there was only really at the time around the country one television station. And if you lived in Jerusalem and lucky, you had a second out of Jordan. And I joke with my parents that the reason why I always felt at home in Egypt was as a result of the Friday afternoon movies that were broadcast on Israeli television that came from Egypt. Egypt, for me, I love spending time in Egypt. I've had the great privilege to spend time in much of the Arab/Muslim world. I've traveled to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Morocco, Qatar. I have spent time, unfortunately, you know, with some of the more unfortunate figures of the Arab world, including groups like Hezbollah, Hamas, Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and really trying to get a sense for what these radicals are thinking and what they are promoting. As I kind of look into the future, those are the people that we must be worried about the most. But the vast majority of the Arab world really are peace-seeking individuals. And the ultimate question that I think about when I look at that part of the world is, and I engage with individuals, the questions of, are you promoting ideas of diversity? Do you revere secular institutions? And what weight do you place on the prophetic tradition? Are you essentially trying to make the world a better place, or are you trying to impose your vision of God's law versus man-made law and liberal values? And those are the questions that I ponder as I interact with individuals in that part of the world. And certainly in the context of, you know, we've now done a series of many, many weeks on your radio station in terms of the role of technology. Can we leverage technology to essentially act as a bridge to this part of the world? And using platforms like the Khan Academy, which is a platform that allows education for free when it comes to math, science, physics, chemistry, are we essentially increasing the knowledge quotient and using technology as a bridge to promote the ideas of diversity, secular values, and the part of the prophetic tradition that encourages us to make the world a better place?
Is there any space within Islam to accept secular values?
I think so. I mean, certainly, look, we have a lot of secular institutions throughout the Muslim world today. You have to keep in mind that this is a civilization that until the 12th, 13th century really was the height of civilization. While Europe was in the dark ages and could barely put together a candle, and throughout the Muslim world, you had lights everywhere. When it comes to words like algebra, that is an Arabic word. This was a civilization that was at its height for a very, very long time. And, the Western world does benefit greatly from a lot of the ideas that came out of the Muslim world for a long time. These days, the shoe is on the other foot. And, as we look at building these bridges, this is what gives me hope that, while Europe was in the dark for many years and the Arab world really was at its height, today, unfortunately, the reverse is true, and that I can't help but wonder, what can we do to extend our hand in order to help a part of the world that today, in large measure, is suffering?
Avi, I'm so desperate to want to be positive, but all the reading I'm doing, and believe you me, I'm not an expert on the subject at all, doesn't lead me to feel that.
How can you not? Let's look at some of these great challenges that, you know, we've talked about over the course of the last many weeks. You have, over the course of the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to experience massive, massive challenges on the planet when it comes to artificial intelligence, water security, food security, poverty, etc. And we are seeing countries like Israel and others around the world that are really solving global challenges, and not only Israel. Truly, we're seeing some of these solutions coming out of even the Muslim world. Let's take, for example, Muhammad Yunus, who comes from Bangladesh. Okay, we want to talk about Muslims. One of the great Muslims of our generation, Muhammad Yunus, yeah, who was one of the grandfathers of microfinance and
microloans. He's from the Grameen Bank. He started the Grameen Bank in India. He's absolutely brilliant. He's a brilliant
guy. Exactly right.
I interviewed him.
He's from...
Profound.
That's right. So from Bangladesh, he started the Grameen Bank, and he received the Nobel Prize, I want to say, in 2008. And over the course from 1998 to 2008, the percentage of poverty dropped by 10%, so 1% a year. How can you not be completely hopeful when you see some of these big challenges that we're facing, but these massive solutions that we are actually coming up with as humankind? As we mentioned in, I think, one of the first shows I ever did with you, Egypt is a country that's going to run out of water in literally 6 years. In 6 years, it's going to have a water problem of biblical proportions. It's going to run out of water. It's a country of 100 million people. Iran, a country that today points its missiles at Israel, a country of 80 million individuals, is going to, half of its population is going to run out of water in 20 years. And yet you have a country like Israel that solved its water problem. This is a country that is 60% desert and is literally a water superpower. We have a model. We have a model to allow us to essentially achieve water independence around the world. Look, recently Israel created a box that literally sucks water out of the air because of the humidity that exists. So when you think about these ideas, you think about these challenges, how can you not, Simon, be hopeful and say, wow, we can fight poverty. We can make a difference when it comes to water, when it comes to food, artificial intelligence, space. I mean, these are things that are afflicting the planet and that we are all benefiting from, whether the solution's coming from South Africa or it's coming from Israel or from Bangladesh.
I needed to hear that. I needed to have my paradigm challenged. because it's very easy to get stuck in.
Yeah, once you start looking at the world as a place that is really full of opportunity and promise, I believe that your perspective changes radically. The question that I ask you and each and every one of your listeners is, what can each and every one of us do to make the world a better place? And that doesn't mean that you're going, Simon, to start a technology company. It can start with opening the door for an individual that needs the door open, or helping an old person cross the street, or visiting the sick, or doing your part to make someone feel better. These are basic principles. Look, our sages teach us that the world is built on three things. Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chasadim, the idea of Torah, which I equate to values, hard work, and acts of charity. And societies are going to thrive when they basically combine the ideas of good values, being a mensch, you know, in Yiddish, being a good person as opposed to Vodachaya, being a wild animal, and the idea of hard work and acts of charity.
Avi, I get that, but I also understand that, I mean, each time there's the Arab Spring, for example, when they're on the cusp of something new, something wonderful to do things differently, in fact, it's the Islamists who kind of come to power and take power. And just, this seems to be, I'm not seeing the opportunity that you're saying is there. You're saying world environments are going to force change in that direction.
So let's take two examples, Simon. I take your point. Now let's look at Eastern Europe. If you had looked at Eastern Europe, which was under the thumb of the Soviet Union, and you had looked at this in the country in the context of the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, I don't think you would have seen much hope in that part of the world, in places like Hungary, Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania. I don't think you would have seen, or Estonia, I don't think you would have seen much room for hope. That's one. Now let's specifically zoom into the Arab world. When you look at a place like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, you look at places that are, or even to some degree Saudi Arabia, that are really starting to change their economies and realize that this is a world that is seeing decreasing natural resources and trying to change their economies in order to deal with that. Dubai today happens to be a major hub for innovation and change when it comes to solving some of these challenges. And when I interact with entrepreneurs and innovators from that part of the world that are trying to solve these problems, I am full of hope. That's not to say that there isn't a lot of depressing things that are going on. Look, the situation in Gaza today, very, very depressing. The situation in Iraq, oh my God, you want to curl up and really cry. And ultimately, you look at organizations like ISIS that are beheading individuals and really implementing a very, from my perspective, backward form of government and killing individuals and forcing their women into really a backward position. Yeah, we really do have problems that we need to solve. But ultimately, you look at some of these things that are the forces of history. I tend to think that the forces of history are with those that are seeking light, not darkness. You know, look, it's when you look at the quintessential Jewish prayer, which is on Saturday night, when we separate between the Sabbath and the rest of the week, we say two things. L'havdil ben kodesh l'chol, l'ol l'choshech. We basically try to elevate the mundane and make it holy. We separate the mundane from the holiness, and we try to bring more light to the world. And I challenge your listeners to think about this in the context of what can I do to bring more light to the world. And in places like Israel, we are seeing that. This is a country that is working with Muslims, with Christians, with Jews, and this idea of diversity. If you can harness the ideas of diversity and light, there is nothing we cannot achieve. Nothing.
Could not think of a better place to leave this than there, a bit of positivity and hope.
But a huge
amount of positivity, and I needed to hear that because you do a bit of reading and it doesn't necessarily land up in that place. So thank you, Avi.
Didn't I tell you that he deserves a Nobel?
You did.
Listen, Avi Oresh, when are you coming to South Africa? Have you got any plans?
When are you inviting me back? I need an invitation. I'll be happy to come.
Okay. All right. Let's see what we can do. I think that you would fill halls, and I think that universities would also be very interested.
South Africa, when I came a few months ago, really, it was a wonderful, wonderful trip. My wife is actually originally from Kenya. So any opportunity to come back to your part of the world is one that I welcome.
Amazing. Avi Oresh, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your thoughts with us, and for leaving us inspired this week. Look forward to speaking to you again next week. God bless. Bye-bye.